Almost 2 out of every 5 New Yorkers is an immigrant, and if you are not one of them, then you are either related to one, love one, or no one. But now, our city of immigrants is starting to feel more like a city of fear. That's the headline of a new report by New York Magazine. It's a collaboration with the Marshall Project. The story is trying to paint a picture of how life changed for undocumented immigrants living under the Trump administration. This was a huge project, involving hundreds of interviews and several different reporters. It captures a range of experiences from ICE arrests to detainment to the struggle of having your mother, father, brother, or friend deported. Genevieve Smith is New York Magazine editor at large. She's here with us today, and so is Ivy Tung Lay. Ivy is a DACA recipient and a subject of the story. Ivy, Genevieve, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having us.
So, Ivy, the headline is Living in Fear. How scared are you?
I get the question quite often. And I think that the question I would ask folks is, how would you feel if you were ripped away from your home? And it's the idea of fearing the unknown and being forced to exit a place that you have been so familiar with. And then the rest of the world just seems like complete blackness to me. On the day of election, I put all of my important documents in one place in case I get that knock on the door. I had a family meeting talking about what it would be like if I had to go back home by myself. I thought about spending my last summer in New York, and every holiday just felt like, oh, this is going to be my last one here.
So you have a to-go bag. You have everything wrapped up just in case they knock on the door.
Yeah.
Did you ever think when you were applying for DACA, when you got that approval, that you'd be living under this fear?
I knew that I had to give a lot to the government because they, in exchange for a 2-year renewable work permit, which again is not a status, you have to give them 10 years of residential history, your travel document information, copies of everything, and even fingerprint appointments so that there's an extensive background check. So to me, it was that this was the one shot we had at proving that the DREAM Act is something that is net positive for the economy and for the country, and we had to give it our shot. And 5 years later, our current president has decided to take it away.
Take it away. Now, you're not alone, Genevieve. The number from this article is just so startling. 500,000 people living in fear of deportation in New York City alone. That's the number that you highlight, and it just stings. So the scope of your team's reporting is tremendous. So many sources. You cite more than 100 people in this piece. Was it difficult for you to get them to come forward?
Sure. I mean, as you said, we partnered with the Marshall Project, which is a nonprofit that does criminal justice reporting, and they just had a huge team just fan out across the city. They contacted every group that works with immigrant populations, and it was months in the making. I think this started back in February, maybe. So it was a long time to get people coming forward. And there were certain communities that even just the final weeks we were just trying to get, especially the Chinese community was one of them, were trying to get someone who wasn't too scared to talk, you know, because they're living with such tremendous fear. And one of the things, so that 500,000 is undocumented immigrants in New York. But one of the things that's happening is people who have some kind of status are also living in fear. People who've gotten, you know, countries that have had earthquakes or other tragedies, they've been allowed to stay. So ICE knows about them and has known about them for a long time. And for a long time, they were, as long as they followed the laws, paid their taxes and all of that, they could stay here. And all of a sudden, those people are vulnerable as well. So it's not just the undocumented. It's people with all sorts of, I mean, people who had, you know, a misdemeanor marijuana charge from 30 years ago, and they're all of a sudden, they're being asked to leave. So people who really had felt safe and had made their home here, had children here, been here for decades, maybe they're the only person without status in their family, without citizenship status in their family, and all of a sudden, they're being asked to leave as well.
And that's, I mean, it's frightening. Ivy, you were telling me earlier that there's some unique fears in the Asian community in New York mm-hmm. City. What are those fears?
I think one is there is a less sophisticated cultural and ethnic media in the Asian community to really explain the implication of applying for DACA. So that's one. And also within the Asian community, we have hundreds of dialects and smaller communities that then break down into different segments of how early they've arrived in America. And that fear, specifically for the Chinese community, has to come with one where we're not necessarily taught to practice our political rights because of the culture that we come from back in mainland China. And so when we have a legislation that doesn't necessarily, rather not legislation, an executive order that doesn't necessarily guarantee a path to citizenship, but asks for all of your information, the first thought is this a bait and switch?
So this mm-hmm. is the first thought culturally here in New York City for the Chinese population. Is this a bait and switch? Back when DACA was being offered, you said, no, it isn't a bait and switch. Mm-hmm. But now you go back to your community.
Right.
And what are they telling you?
Man, we were right. That's what they're telling us. And it's really heartbreaking because I feel like every stride we make is what carries us over to the next mountain. And this administration has really taken back what we thought was moving forward before the election. And so right now, it's more about how do we continue to educate our communities about our rights versus how to advance forward to a path to citizenship.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Ivy Tung Lei. She's a DACA recipient who came to New York City at the age of 7 and is now one of hundreds of thousands of people in New York who are living in fear. We're also talking with Genevieve Smith. She's New York Magazine editor at large. Genevieve, this article was really amazingly well done. I was struck by how powerful it is. At times, it's a really tough read, I want to be honest with you, because you don't give us the luxury of distance. Instead, you don't have reporters tell the stories. You have actual people who are living in fear tell their own stories. Now, there was this one section called Asylum Seekers Have to Prove Their Credible Fear, where we learn about a doctor who volunteers examining detainees. And these are his own words. About a month ago, I evaluated a 30-year-old Honduran man who was attacked with a machete by a gang that killed his brother in front of him. He ended up having a scar on the right side of his scalp. The scar was not clean cut. It was irregular and messy, and because he hadn't gotten proper suturing afterward, he would not only get beaten up by gangs, but also by the police. He was also a victim of child abuse and was raped by a family friend. He started trembling when he talked about it, and he said to me, "Why can't this life just finish?" So difficult to read that. Why did you choose that approach?
I mean, exactly for what you're talking about. It's so easy to become numb to all of this, to everything that's happening, and to distance yourself from it. And what we found, we use this approach that we call it the as told to's. That's our sort of in-house language for it. But really letting the people tell their own stories rather than being mediated through a reporter, we found that it kind of breaks down your defenses. You feel like you're talking to a person and they're telling you their experience. And part of the point of doing something like this is to shock you out of your comfort, shock you out of this feeling like, well, we're in New York, we're a sanctuary city, everything is fine here. Mm. Well, it's not fine here. It's the best place you could be an undocumented immigrant, but it's not fine. And I think it's effective. I hope so.
It's just shocking and a little scary. I mean, so the article, you cite a lot of facts, and here are some of the facts. You know, during the first 8 months of the Trump administration, ICE arrests in New York City soared 67%. Another startling fact, arrests of immigrants with no criminal convictions were up 225%. ICE arrested 2,031 people during Trump's first 8 months in office. So we're at month 20.
Sure.
Do the numbers keep rising?
Well, there's not great data on this, unfortunately, but we do know that there have been 20,000 New Yorkers where deportation actions have begun. So that doesn't necessarily mean they will be deported. It's actually one of the little bit of cold comforts here in New York is that if you are, we have very, very high rates of those actions starting because we have so many immigrants, but we also have probably the best legal defense for undocumented immigrants. About 80% of immigrants who go through these procedures will end up with a lawyer. We have, the mayor has put aside $30 million for legal aid for immigrants going through this. So we're lucky in that sense. But I think, yes, I mean, anecdotally, it does seem that the numbers just keep getting bigger.
So if you're an immigrant in New York City and you are detained, proportionally, you have a higher chance of getting out, obviously. I mean, that's little comfort to people who lose mm-hmm. their loved ones. But
and it also doesn't account for, well, how long are you going to be in detention? I mean, mm-hmm. you might have a family where the sole provider is in a jail. It is a county jail. There are people who are criminals incarcerated for regular crimes in there, as well as detainees. And you might be without your provider. You might be without your parent. You might be without, you know, your child. It's cold comfort for sure.
If you're just joining us, we want you to take part in this conversation. If you're an undocumented immigrant, give us a call and tell us about your own experience living in a city of fear. Our number is 212-433-9692. Again, that number is 212-433-9692. And if you don't want to disclose your identity because it's a scary situation right now, that's okay too. You're welcome to give us a fake name. We want to make sure that your voice is being heard in your city. So Ivy, have you ever felt that you could not speak up? Obviously, as a DACA person, you are by default public. Mm-hmm. But has your voice gotten a little bit quieter ever since the pressure has been mounting?
Oh, certainly. I think, one, as a DACA recipient, I have a lot more privilege to take a stance because at the end of the day, I do have something called deferred action for childhood arrival versus a lot of other undocumented immigrants. So that's thing one. Thing two is, it was almost as if the floodgate of hate comments and like death threats, turned on immediately after the night of election. And I've had my personal accounts hacked, and I couldn't access my personal like email or even social media accounts. There has been so many comments under a lot of the articles that I've, you know, been featured in where the publication would just straight out flag it as violence. And, you know, it's so heartbreaking to know that there are people who want bad things to happen to me. And I just don't know what I've done.
You've been here since you were 7 years old.
I've been here since I was seven.
You get death threats.
I get death threats.
You ever ask yourself, what would killing me accomplish?
I think these people, yeah, I do. And I think these people are angry about something that I have no way of solving. And I'm a face to it. And I don't regret being the face to this movement at all. But the human side of me makes me cringe so much every single second.
Can I ask if you feel like it makes you more of a target for ICE or something like that? Because I know we have one immigrant in the story who mm-hmm. was an activist mm-hmm. who felt that he was put on, I mean, he was deported and he felt mm-hmm. like he was put on a plane because they knew him from yeah. his activism.
I have a lot of mentors who are in the media space, and they will come up to me and tell me that don't talk. Like, I know you're passionate about it, and I know you want this to be a story that people need to hear, but you have to know that your name is out there, and thereby they will find a way to deport you. I mean, DACA recipients can get their work permit taken away for jaywalking, for jumping a turnstile. Like, the difference between regular immigration law, immigration crime, rather, what's considered a crime considered for an immigrant is very different for a regular U.S. citizen. And so by that, we're living life on an edge to begin with.
Welcome. Welcome back. I'm Duarte Geraldino, and I'm talking with Genevieve Smith about a recent investigation by New York Magazine about the city in fear. Also with us is Ivy Tung Lei. She is the DACA recipient and a subject of the story. Ladies, I understand that this investigation also showed some patterns with maps that were very, very enlightening. You uncovered places where it seems you're more likely to get detained, to arrested. What did you find?
Well, I will say that the numbers, the collection of this information is so spotty. But what you can see is that there are significant numbers of immigrants who are picked up outside courthouses in all of the boroughs. And there have been reports anecdotally of ICE agents hanging out outside of courthouses. And sometimes there'll be, you know, people, activists will alert on Twitter that, look, there's ICE agents here. You should stay away from your court. But imagine the choice that you have to make. Do I show up for my court date and possibly get detained by ICE? Or do I follow the rules that I'm trying to follow to stay here and do everything right and go to my court date? It's a horrible choice for these people.
There's so many horrible choices to make. Vilma, she is one of our listeners. She's on the phone right now with us. Vilma, what's your story?
Well, I've been in this country since I was 13 years old. I came through legal means. My mom moved to the United States from the Dominican Republic. She came, she worked, and then she became a citizen and petitioned for me and my brothers and my sister to come to the United States. I went to high school here, and I went to college here, graduated, been working, and paying my taxes as a devoted citizen of this country. But just days before the election, I was coming home from work, and one of my neighbors, she's, you know, white American, she was very upset, and she was, you know, fighting with me, and I just said, hey, I just coming from work, just coming from my office. And what she said to me was, the only office that immigrants know is the welfare office. Ooh. And that for me, like, that was a punch, you know, in my stomach, that people think like that. You know, I don't carry my citizenship and my diploma in my head. We come here, we work. I've been working and paying taxes and my brothers and my family for many years, and we don't come here to take anybody's job or to ask the government to support us. We come as immigrants came from Italy and Germany and Ireland back in the days, and we work hard. Yes, there are bad people there, but there are, you know, bad people in every community. So even in communities like Washington Heights, where the majority of us that live there are immigrant, you find people that are very, very racist. And I just hope that, you know, things start to change soon. And we have to go out there, we have to vote, and we have to change, because this is not the America that we signed for. I'm a citizen, and we have many people in my family that are citizens. We hope that this gets better and not worse.
Thank you so much, Vilma. So
thank you.
Vilma brings up the question of racism in this. Mm-hmm. Genevieve, you present as a white American. I'm not sure if that's the case, but this is what you present as. And Ivy, you know, you say you were born in China.
Mm-hmm.
What role did racism have in the way that you're dealing with this? Is there a racist element mm-hmm. to it?
I think the first thing people say when I tell them I'm undocumented is that, well, you don't look like it. And then I would ask them, what does that look like? What does an undocumented person look like to you? And so that's thing one. And then thing two is that I actually had a friend who is also a DACA recipient, and he is from Mexico. And he interviewed for a job at a Fortune 500 company. And they gave him an offer and saw his employment authorization card and immediately asked him, are you going to be deported after 2 years? And I've never gotten that question.
Like, is it because you're Asian and he was Latino?
I think so. And I mean, I've interviewed for so many jobs, and I never had that question. They don't even know what DACA is.
I do think that there are assumptions that people, I mean, I think there's sort of two answers to that question. One is, I don't know if the policies are racist or xenophobic. I'm not totally sure. I could parse that. They're certainly xenophobic. There's no question about that. But I do think it's true that in a lot of people who are natural citizens, they're in their assumptions about who has status and who should be here and who, you know, who, even if they're sort of, even if their values are pro-immigrant, they certainly don't necessarily realize who's vulnerable. They do make assumptions, you know, in part because of just the news right now, right? You know that there are so many people fleeing Central America who are coming here over the border. And so when you think about the issue, you're probably thinking more about Latin America. And you're not necessarily thinking about Chinese population and Korean population in New York and all these other undocumented population.
I mean, or even white Europeans.
There's Irish, certainly there's Irish, undocumented Irish that we interviewed for this story. I've had Canadian friends who are undocumented who are here. So I do think that people tend to think about it in very limited terms. They don't realize the full spectrum.
So are your Canadian friends or your Irish friends being locked up in detention facilities too?
Well, in this very personal Canadian example, they left before all of this. So it's not, but they certainly got stopped at the border and they lived with a lot of fear, but it was nothing like what we're going through right now. And the Irish woman that we interviewed for the story, I do think that she has a little bit of, I mean, I would be interested to see how she didn't feel the fear in the same way. She'd been here for a very long time. And I think that she did live with the assumption that people didn't think that she had any status issues. So there probably was a little bit of privilege that she got from that. I don't know how she sees it.
We have Joseph from Seattle, one of our listeners, who wants to join the conversation. Joseph, what's your story?
Hi, how you guys doing? Well, it's not my story. It's my father's story, my uncle's story, individuals. So I'm from the Bangladeshi community, and they all came here essentially, I would say, some of them like legally through the Amnesty Act, and then others, such as my uncle, came here illegally. And one of the reasons was because they were political refugees, they were being persecuted and so on in Bangladesh. So New York City offered a safe haven for them. But now when I look around what's happening, there's a big change. And within the Bangladeshi community itself, there's this sense of like uncertainty. People who would normally go to work, like they look at exit options, or rather exit doors when they go to work. Like, what happens if the police come? How can I get out really quickly? Which is really, really sad. And then the other big thing that's happening is there's this rise of McCarthyism-like behavior that's happening within the community as well. And what I mean by that is, when people before would have problems, they would go to court, they'll try to settle out the problems. Now, if they know that the other person is undocumented, they'll just say, oh, I'll just call the police on you, or I'll call ICE on you. What are you going to do? And so it's almost being used as a blackmail tactic amongst members within the community. And that's the part that gets me hurt the most. So our community, the Bangladeshi community, is one of the largest growing South Asian populations in New York City. And it's, you know, it saddens me to think that there are people who, you know, dedicated their whole lives to get here, you know, so that their parents, so that their families, their kids can have a better opportunity. And, you know, the government, or rather, you know, who's to say that they don't deserve to be here, right? They deserve to be here as much as everyone else. But, you know, people within our own community are using that as a means of blackmail, as a means of saying, no, you don't belong here. We belong here. You didn't come here the right way. So it's a very, very sad situation that we're all in right now.
Thank you so much, Joseph. You make such an important point. Ivy, so Joseph is essentially saying that people are weaponizing our immigration laws. So if there's a small issue, if they don't like you, or if they're a dispute where they may be in the wrong, they may use immigration status as a weapon. Have you found that? Have you had any experience with someone threatened to call immigration agents on you?
Oh, I've had my ex-boyfriend use it on me. And like, if we look back into the history of this country, the first discriminatory ban on immigrants coming in is the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act. And so the history of people using the otherness, quote unquote, to then blackmail those is so prominent in American culture.
It's very difficult to hear that an ex-boyfriend, someone that in theory you loved, tried to use that on you. And I know in the article we speak about how abuse, domestic abuse, may rise because of the unequal playing field with immigration status. Obviously, you're a strong woman, but how did that story end when he threatened you?
I think it was that I've known this person for so long and loved, and that's the one thing that I would never, ever want to hear from a stranger, let alone someone who I was so intimate with. And I immediately felt unsafe. I felt like a cloud was hanging over my head. And it was like anxiety attacks and panic attacks. And I just had to, I had the choice to leave because it was a relationship, you know, and had the right guidance of friends and family. But I know so many people who don't, and they feel like they're indebted.
See, you're unique because even though your status is tenuous, you do have DACA, which means you could go to police if something were to happen to you. But do you feel as if, were you not college educated, were you lacking the ability to communicate so well in English, and a lover or a boyfriend or a husband threatened you, what would you do?
Oh, man, I don't know. I would just hide him in the corner and cry. I don't know. I would feel like who else can I depend on if the law enforcement's not on my side, if my loved one is not on my side, my family depended on me. This is the story of undocumented immigrants who are constantly feeling like they can't ask for help, because the moment they ask for help, they're exposing themselves and being vulnerable.
We have a couple of people who just want to know, did you tell him to just get out of here? I mean, you're
No, we broke up. No, that's the thing. I broke up with him, and then he said, you know, I could have given you what you needed.
Ooh.
And that was the part that hurt the most, is that at the point of us breaking up is him acknowledging that he was using that to string this relationship along, completely disregarding everything else. So yeah, absolutely kicked him out of my life. And I'm proud to say that now I am with the love of my life now, who would never ever do that to me and has attended DACA rallies with me. And he's amazing. And so for those who are listening and feel that they are in a situation where they're being manipulated and being emotionally, maybe even physically abused, get out of there. Seek help. There are so many nonprofits out there who will connect you to someone who can help you directly. And be strong, because that's the only thing we have control over in today's world.
It's wonderful that your story ends well, and I'm so happy that you are strong to be able to get out of that situation. But Genevieve, you say that sometimes people getting help get caught, and they get into these detention centers. What's that path to detention like?
Well, there are... we heard such a variety of stories of what landed people in detention. There are people who had were checking in with their ICE in their regular check-ins that they were going to. They were on the radar of immigration for years. They checked in regularly. They tried to do everything right. They go in for their regular check-in under the Trump administration. Most of the stories that people were telling were really they felt a change had happened after 2016, and all of a sudden they were detained. They were like without their lawyer, without any plans, without being able to tell their children who was going to pick them up from school. They were just whisked away to these detention centers, and some of them were eventually deported. Some of them were lucky to have a lawyer help them get out. There was a woman sort of speaking to what you're talking about who she had an argument with her sister-in-law, and the sister-in-law called the cops, and the ICE came to her door and took her away in front of her kids and put her in detention. There are just all different kinds of stories, and that fear of like just the one misstep. And there's also the people who, as you're talking about, who they are so afraid of losing their provider or of being deported themselves that they don't report abuse. There's victims of sex trafficking who feel that they're stuck, that they have to stay with their abuser because they're undocumented. It's really horrible, the things that people will put up with. And then if you end up in detention, it really is like jail. They are correctional facilities that you're being held in. The everything about the way that your day is scheduled, your access to fresh air, everything is as if you're in jail.
Mm-hmm. As if you're in jail.
You are. I mean, technically,
it's
you
marketing
are.
Terms.
Yeah,
it's the same thing.
It's the same facility.
Now, Ivy, you mentioned that you had that bag just in case the worst happens. But in the article, you also go through tips. And the degree to which they're so specific broke my heart about things you should do if ICE officials knock on the door. You even mentioned not having your fingerprint on your phone. Why?
Well, because the ICE can compel you to unlock your phone with your fingerprint. And what they've found, what the activists have found, is that they'll unlock someone's phone and they'll use it as a directory of where to go next. Who else should we, like, they'll just take all the phone number, all the contact information, and like, okay, well, here's our strategy for the next month. We're going to try to get to all of these people. So, you know, the other thing that they said is if you videotape an ICE raid. So we talked to activists who had taken this training. We talked to the activists who were giving these trainings. And, you know, they found recently, especially, that these videos can be incredibly helpful for helping to stay a deportation, helping to protect the immigrant communities. You try to shoot them so that you're not getting the face of the immigrants in the video. You try to get multiple angles. You try to say as little as possible yourself.
And that's key. You shut up and let it roll. Why do you not want to say it?
Well, anything that you say, you're in a heightened emotional state. Anything that you say could then be used against you. So you want to try to get the landmarks so we know where we are without getting the faces of the immigrants, and make sure everything automatically uploads to the cloud in some form, Dropbox or iCloud.
Why is that so critical that it automatically uploads?
There have been cases where the ICE agents took the phone and erased everything on the phone and gave it back to you. So you want to know you have that automatic up, so you have a copy of whatever it is. And then if you have a number code, it's much harder for them to compel you to unlock your phone.
Is there a certain number of digits you should have?
I think one of the groups said that you should try to do an 8-digit instead of a 6-digit. I mean, certainly the longer, the harder it is for them to just guess it.
And then finally, if you are filming, what should you be focused on? Should you be focused on the immigrant or the agent?
I think you want to see what the agents are doing, how they are. You know, there's all kinds of protocols that they need to follow. And part of what you're looking for is to document that they actually followed these protocols, that they identified themselves and that they, you know, that they had the proper judge's order to come in and stuff like that, that they didn't harm anyone in the process. So you want your focus to be on them for sure.
Thank you so much, Genevieve, for this work, this great article. And Ivy, thank you for sharing your story. Now, I'm Duarte Geraldino, and you've been listening to New York Magazine editor Genevieve Smith about their investigation, City of Fire. It was reported in partnership with the Marshall Project. Ivy Tung Lei is a DACA recipient. She is featured in the story and also joined the conversation.